everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month. So this month, I went for a lowball manga of the month, but I felt like we should talk about it at least once. I made Pup Team Epic the manga of the month.
Why is that not a good choice?
I guess it's not that it's a good choice. I feel like we usually pick a little more obscure shows and manga, but every once in a while we should just talk about something that's fun and maybe... I don't feel like it's not like I was like, My Hero Academia.
I thought about doing that one time, like not even that long ago. And it's like, why? I can do better. I mean, not that I don't think it's good.
Yeah.
But like.
Like, do you really need to tell anybody about My Hero Academia?
If I do, it's like on an individual level.
We also have a whole bunch of SWATs for the new season, because of a hectic schedule, we're a little more behind. So, if you haven't checked them out, we have a few SWATs there. If anything, we got to watch a few more episodes, so we have a slightly more informed opinion about some of these shows.
And, of course, it's the end of the year, so we're doing a lot of wrap-up stuff. We'll have our best picks for anime and manga for the year in December. We'll be wrapping up all of the licenses for the year and some various other, you know, stuff that we do here at the end of the year.
Listen to our song! The most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
So in this episode of the Speakeasy, we are going to do it a little differently because we have a special guest.
Hello, I'm Patrick. Pat's from the Cockpit Podcast.
And we were all at Anime NYC, so we're just going to dedicate the whole episode to talking about our experience there and get Pat's perspective, because we've all three of us have attended the first year and then the sophomore year of the con. Did you go in feeling like the con immediately felt different from the first year?
I would say it definitely felt bigger.
I don't think the first year didn't sell out any days, did it? Or I don't particularly remember it doing so.
Yeah,
I don't think it did poorly or anything.
No, it did great.
Yeah, but I don't think they usually make a big to-do when it sells out like it did Saturday and Sunday. And I think with even though it had more size, you felt, especially Saturday, that there were just more people there and there was more stuff.
I think it felt, like, immediately bigger. Like, for a lot of reasons, one, the way it was laid out was, like, it was bigger. The exhibit hall and the panel rooms are all on the main floor of the Javits Center. They changed that this year. They put the panel rooms downstairs in one of the basement halls with all the traditional panel rooms in it. And just expanded the size of the exhibit hall. So it felt bigger in that regard immediately because it just, it was bigger. It had more space, right? And then everything, like, you also feel like initial walking in kind of feeling. Like, that's what it felt like, walking in. And then as the con went on, it just felt, like, more crowded and bigger. And, like, there was a lot more going on, I feel like.
And for me, the first year, I didn't actually go on Friday because I think it was like, you know, it was close to the holiday, work, whatever, got in the way. So I actually didn't kind of see the con open, like, oh, okay, here's the first moment. And this time around, we were there early on Friday for autograph tickets. So we really were there from the moment it got started until the end.
I remember when, because Pat's did his robot panel, the round table.
Yes, we did Mecha Fight Club.
Mecha Fight Club. And when I first came in...
Last year.
And it was one of the first panels on Friday.
It was in the first year. I was a little worried because there didn't seem to be that many people. But it was one of those things that essentially once school and work let out, the Friday filled in a lot more. Then I was like, oh, all right. It was just, you know, it was just the morning was a little dead.
Yeah.
And I don't even think we had that experience this year.
I mean, like,
it was less than you would see Saturday and Sunday, but I feel like
it was like Saturday this year felt significantly busier. Friday probably felt about the same, I would say. Friday probably felt like Saturday last year, and Saturday this year felt like Otakon in some ways. Especially at some points in, like, midday Saturday, where there was, like, a crazy line to get into the exhibit hall and stuff like that.
And I noticed that I was kind of concerned when they moved to the panel rooms. Mm. So, like Pat's mentioned, first year they were right next to the exhibit hall. Essentially, you could see them from the exhibit hall and you could just move between them pretty freely.
Yeah.
And so this year I was like, oh, okay, you know, they've moved them so that there can be more room in there and they can have bigger panels. And of course there was like a noise component to that too. Mm-hmm. But I was also like, oh, how is this going to affect panel attendance? Because now it's not just like immediately within your line of sight. And it didn't seem to affect it. Like, there were like, every panel I went to was more than half full, and sometimes was turning people away.
Especially if it was a premiere.
Yeah, if there was, like, a screening of anything, for the most part, you know, they were really full. Especially on Saturday, it was, like, impossible to get into certain events. So they were really packing them out, and I thought that was a function of there wasn't... You know, it's a con that grew a lot from the first year to the second year, but there wasn't a lot more content from the first year to the second year.
There are only four panel rooms, and those panel rooms are also used for the premieres and screenings and all that kind of stuff. So there's four rooms.
And the main stage.
And the main stage. Most panels are only 45 minutes, for that matter. And, yeah, so there wasn't, like, a ton more content or anything this year. It was just, like... the rooms were bigger, I think, I think people just were spread out more, because there was a lot more space in the exhibit hall, and Artist Alley was the same, and there's a lot more, like, moving around as a result of spreading everything out like that.
But yeah, I just felt like there, you know, at any given time, there was still a fairly limited amount of things to do.
Yes.
So I think, but I think that was good. I'm not actually complaining, but I think that's what helped keep the panel rooms full, was that there wasn't like a game room, yeah. which is a,
there wasn't
become
a staple. There's an arcade area, or an arcade though.
Oh, was there where?
The back left corner of the exhibit hall was the game, and that's how they did it last year, where it was just part of the exhibit hall, but it was like towards the front and kind of prominent last year, whereas it was kind of shoved in the back this year, because they had more like dance games and stuff this year, so they probably just needed more space for it. But it was actually a substantial like chunk of like machines.
I didn't even see that.
And it was, you know what, there was usually a pretty like at least 3-person thick wall around it because of people waiting or watching other people playing. Yeah. So I never went there and did not see just a bunch of people around those machines.
Yeah, because I mean, there's like a whole community around going to play those games at cons, so they all go. You had plenty of fighting games, had all the dancing games, had a bunch of the music games. Basically everything you'd expect to see at a convention. Had Taiko. It had the whole gamut. It's weirdly shoved in that corner, though, instead of just having its own room or something like that. Because at this point, they could put it in its own room, and it would probably be fine that way.
Yeah, I didn't even realize it was there. So, because I feel like the game area is usually a pretty packed part of a con all the time. So, that's just something else to do. So,
this is a rando kind of aside, but did you ever walk by the booth that had the DJ doing...
I was totally about to bring that up!
Because, so they were selling, like, fancy glow sticks and stuff for the concerts. And then they also had, like, a DJ. And it's, like, the Annie Party guys, if you look that up. They do, like, literally, like, any song, like, DJ sets at, like, clubs. And they were just playing shit, and then people would... There's, like, a whole pit of people surrounding this booth. And it's, like, in the middle of the exhibit hall. It was in the awful location for them to be doing this. But it was actually super fun.
And they did give it a pretty wide berth.
Yeah.
So, like, even though I always saw it and always saw people around it, I didn't have a lot of problems navigating that area. They at least gave it some space. Mm-hmm. But I was definitely thrown off by it. I was like, wait, there's like a dance party at all times
in the middle of the dealer's room.
Instead of having a rave, I guess.
The thing that threw me off the most about it was the one time they played Stone Cold, the opening to Sacred Seven, which I thought was a fun opening, but I was like, somebody else remembered that opening. Weird. Because most of the other times it was like songs you would kind of expect to be.
A lot of stuff from the guests, like the musical guests at the con. Mm-hmm. Like the one day I was walking by there and I was talking to a friend who's super into Morning Musume. And like every couple minutes she'd like stop and pause because they'd start playing another Morning Musume song.
Yeah, I heard at least 3 when I was just randomly in the exhibitors hall, so.
I honestly couldn't identify them if you told me I did, but I did. Except Love Machine, that's like the one I know. Anyway, you could also buy glow sticks there, so you could, you know.
I didn't actually know they were selling anything at that booth, because I never got that close to it.
No, they had all the good kind.
So, okay, so I think almost every big name company for anime or manga was represented. I think the only one that seemed prominently missing to me was Seven Seas, but I don't even know.
They don't do a lot of cons.
I was going to say, do they do cons at all?
They do AX in San Diego.
So they must be.
They're over there. Portland?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're in Portland. So yeah, they're West Coast, and they're not a big staff either way. So like, they don't do a lot of cons. They weren't at Otakon or anything either.
Yeah, I noticed that.
But Viz did show up, which is significant because Viz tends to ignore the East Coast unless it's very important.
What I will say, so this is going to be a little bit of a tangent again, but it speaks to like the exhibit hall thing, and the con is very heavily industry oriented.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, in the way the exhibit hall's structured, in the the programming, all of that kind of stuff. It's very industry centric. So like you're like, well, Viz doesn't show up on the East Coast. Viz specifically tends to not show up at Otakon is what you actually mean.
And well, it doesn't go up to Boston, Anime Boston.
Sure, sure, but like My point being, in Boston, it's the same way as Otakon in this regard. They're not industry-oriented cons. They're fan-oriented cons. Like, if you look at Otakon's program, the reason Otakon's like, if you ask people like us, the reason Otakon's the best con is, one, all our friends go there. Two, they have, like, the best, like, programming because they have a high concentration of really quality fan-produced content. A con like this is more interested in courting like industry and bringing in a bunch of like companies, and as a result their content is very industry focused, which I'm sure for a company like Viz is way more appealing. The third thing, and this goes
AB3
this speaks back to the exhibit hall thing, actually, so I can bring this all the way back around to what we were actually talking about. The way the con is laid out is a big part of it, I think. Because the way the Javits is laid out... So the Javits is the worst convention center on Earth.
It's real bad, guys.
It's real bad. But here's the important thing. Because of the way it's laid out, and specifically the part where Anime NYC is laid out, when you go in the front door, if you walk straight, you literally just walk into the exhibit hall. You literally walk from the front door into the dealer's room. And there's not like, unless you know you're specifically going to go to a panel where you turn left and you go down the stairs, or you want to go to the artist alley where you turn right and go up the stairs, you're getting shuffled straight into the exhibit hall. That is the center of the con. It's very much like a San Diego or New York Comic Con in that sense. Again, this is also run, this is a for-profit con. It's designed that way, like, to shuffle you into its exhibit hall so you can go spend money at all these big vendors and all that kind of stuff. It's very structured that way, and that's why, like, when you walk around that exhibit hall, it's, you know, there's Viz, there's Crunch, or Crunchyroll, there's Sentai, Aniplex. There's Funimation, there's Aniplex. Aniplex's booth was huge. There was Pony Canyon, there was Kodansha, there was Yen Press, the Denpa, who else was that? That's like everybody that was there. Like, that, like there,
Sentai, did you say Sentai?
I don't know if I said Sentai, whatever. But Sentai had a big-ass booth, too. Like, everyone had a big-ass booth. And, like, when you walked in, that was everything that was up front, too. G-Kids. Like, all of the big industry booths were the first thing you entered, and the first thing you saw, and you had to veer off from them to get to anything else. Like, that was, like, very and very deliberately, like, here's what this con is about. It's an industry con. It's just not a hell beast like an anime expo, so it's still fun.
Yeah, but I guess it is similar to the way Expo is very, like, what do they have, like, 3 fan panels the whole weekend or whatever?
That's, like, more or less what they had to hear.
Yeah, and there was, like, none of the content that I went to was, like, almost everything I went to was, like, a screening, pretty much. And then, like, a couple of, like, I went to a voice actor spotlight or whatever. But for the most part, it was, like, screenings, so that was obviously brought by industry.
Yeah.
I went to this Ippudan ramen panel, and I was hoping... I knew they were gonna, you know, play up the restaurant chain, but I was hoping it would be, like, 70% ramen information, 30% commercial. But it was, like, 90% commercial, 10% ramen information. And I like them because they're single booth ramen, so you don't actually have to interact with anyone. It's what do you call it? I'm a misanthrope. I like that, but I was like, you know, you could, like, at least pretend not to be just, you know, a big commercial for your ramen chain. Give me some, like, because last year I went to that ramen panel and it was super informative, but this year I was just like, this panel, I was just like, all right. And I just, like, left halfway through.
So, yeah, I think, I mean, it's almost like because I have not gone to great... Almost like maybe because I didn't go to great lengths to, like, be here. Like, I was pretty cool with the content. I thought it was pretty relaxing, and mostly if I'm going to screenings, which I honestly love being able to go see anime at an anime con. So, if, like, a higher industry presence results in that, like, I'm not totally opposed to it. I mean, it definitely does, you know? Right?
Like,
I mean, I want to see the new stuff. There's a lot of this con. Yeah.
So, I know I've said this to at least one person after this con, where programming-wise specifically, and I guess we're kind of veering off from the exhibit hall stuff, but, like, whatever. Programming-wise, if everything stayed the same and they just added 2 more rooms and made them fan panel rooms, I think I would call this one of the best cons I mean, I still think it is one of the best cons you can go to right now, but, like, it would be even better. Like, but again, I think, I don't think that's happening, because I just don't think that's a priority for them. Their priority is very clearly the industry presence stuff, and, like, well, oh, yeah, the second part of my point is, like, that's clearly not a priority, and how much, like...
extra draw is it?
Yeah. Like, how much does that matter to the majority of the people that go to this con? It grew significantly in a year. So, over 10,000 people in a year. Yeah. How much does not having me talking about old robot cartoons affect the attendance?
Right. I think if... But to your point from the beginning of wherever we started with this, yeah, is that because they're not as fan-centered, their priority is, like, I don't know, butts in the seats, people, oh, yeah, in the hall, you know? So, like, I feel like, yeah, maybe at some point that will be a problem. But, like, I feel like right now it's, to me, not like, a problem to them. But, like, for me, like, right now, because it's small.
It's small enough that you can still go to programming. But, like, if it gets too big, that industry programming won't be enough programming for everybody to go to, kind of thing.
Yeah, or, like, it just won't...
It won't be for you?
I don't know if it won't be for me, but it might feel like Al going to the... This is, like, so much of a commercial, mm-hmm, at this point. But at the same time, I mean, I really like going to New York Comic Con, and that's a very industry-oriented, you know, like, there's no real fan... There is some fan content there, but it's still more professionals, yeah, doing fan content. Like, maybe they're not part of a company, but it's more done by professionals, mm-hmm, as opposed to what we're kind of more used to at an Otakon for panels that are run by non-industry.
What I will say, like, and I think it does help this con at, like, this stage in it, especially, like, this year, because they had all these screenings and they had a lot of interesting guests. Those things kind of took up a lot of the schedule by themselves. So, like, there was plenty to do at the convention if you specifically did not want to go to, like, Sentai's, like, we're going to announce some stuff, Sentai's industry panel or Funimation's industry panel. Like, if you don't want to go to those things, there's still plenty of stuff for you to do. And I think that's just the nature of... They've brought in enough outside stuff that's interesting that they can balance it out. Because I didn't go to... I went to the Denpa panel. That's the only, like, company panel I went to.
I didn't go to any. Never go to those panels, yeah, anymore.
And, like, I only went to that one because, well, it was, like, my friend doing the thing. So, like, that's why I went to that panel. And I was waiting for him to announce a specific title because I was really excited.
And I get that's the reason I went to the end panel, because a friend of the podcast, Carl, was there, and I was like, all right, I'll go and, you know, hey, I'm in the audience. Some of your friends are here. It's not just, asking, horrible questions and making your life difficult.
The one other thing I did actually want to bring up about this, was they stacked a lot of the content on Saturday. A lot of, like, the high-demand content was on Saturday, I felt like. And it felt like, at a point, it was a... It's really forcing you to pick and choose what you're going to. Part of that was, like, for someone like me, because I committed to the 3 or 4 hours that, you know, the Anisong World Matsuri was gonna take. It's like, well, all this other stuff I'd have been interested in is all stacked up against it, kind of thing. So it felt like... The con's programming was very, like, Saturday-centric. We're putting all the most popular stuff on Saturday, which, you know, makes sense. That's when the most people are going to be there, but it's still frustrating.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting that most... Well, I can't say most cons, because, like, I mostly go to Otakon, so I don't know. But yeah. And maybe Anime Next, like, in the past. But I thought it was interesting that the big, giant concert... I mean, there was also a concert on Friday, but yeah, the big, huge... Not Friday. There was one earlier on Saturday.
No, there was one on Friday. There was one Friday night. So there was the first night of the Anisong World Matsuri was Friday night. Then there was the Fate event that had a concert with Aimer, which was Saturday, like, midday, like, afternoon. And then the second night of the Anisong World Matsuri was Saturday night. So there's 3 concerts.
And then It was also, like, on Saturday, often there isn't a concert because that's when the cosplay masquerade big draw thing is.
And they don't do that.
They do.
Did they?
Yeah.
There was a big cosplay contest on Saturday night.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
It was the main events.
I didn't even, I forgot a main events existed.
Yeah, I didn't actually go to main events the whole time. It was where it was last year.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, I still just call it the IGN Theater from New York Comic Con, but they don't even call it that anymore, so whatever. It's the biggest panel room in the convention.
I think that's
center.
Where the Fate thing was, right?
Yeah, and it was where the Thunderbolt concert was last year.
For a minute, I thought you were going to say Thunderbolt Fantasy. I was like, there was a Thunderbolt Fantasy thing!
Their content and, their popularity of their content, obviously that can vary from year to year, but it's already kind of filling to capacity the space that they have. So I'm very interested to see if, we go from year one to year two where we've taken over a little, more of the Javits, and then, are we going from two to three to, taking even over more. Half? Because we're not, I feel like we're at, a third.
I don't think we're even that far. Probably close. It feels like the exhibit hall doesn't need to get any much bigger.
Right, yeah.
It feels almost like it's as big as it needs to be right now. It could get a little bigger, probably, and it probably will get a little bigger. They'll take another piece of it and expand it a little more. But beyond that, the space that it's going to need is bigger panel rooms or more panel rooms.
And then they move the autograph area out of there because that was kind of part of the change this year was autographs and panels were all in the same area.
Yeah.
But
autographs
were
down there last year.
What?
Autographs were down there last year.
Yes. Which I never went to last year, so I didn't know how they did it at all.
Not like this.
No? It was different?
Yeah.
That's good, because it was horrible.
Yeah.
Or maybe last year was even worse, I'm not sure.
I don't know, actually. But it wasn't like this. I don't know. Okay, so I'll explain the autographs thing. So last year I didn't do a normal autograph thing, because the only autographs I got were for buying the ticket for the Thunderbolt event, which, the VIP came with an autograph, and then buying the soundtrack for Thunderbolt, which also came with an autograph. Gundam Thunderbolt, that is. This year, so I don't know how they handled ticketing for the regular autographs last year, I can't remember. This year, the way they handled it was awful. And what they did is, every morning, so every day, there was an allotment, and these were for the con autograph sessions, the one that, the con was putting on. Not ones at, companies' booths or anything like that, where you had to buy them. But, if you wanted to go to, a normal autograph session with Toru Furuya, what you had to do is, so on Friday, you had to get there. So on Friday at 10 a.m., they were going to hand out autograph tickets, and they were going to hand them out until they were all gone. So you had to line up at 8 or whatever, whatever the heck, 8:30 is when we got there, something like that, 9?
We got there about 9.
We had a friend that got there 8:30. So we got in that line. I know people that got there at 6. So we had to be there a little before 10, so we could get in that line. Friday, they made us wait out in the cold this whole time, then they eventually shuffle us in, we get into a line queue, and you literally just, you get to the front of the line, you go up to somebody, and they've got tickets for all the autographs, and you can take two tickets. You say, I want Toru Furuya and Mori Musume. And they give you two tickets for those two autograph sessions. You get those two, and then you can get back in the line if you needed another one, or you can just go. Saturday and Sunday, more or less the exact same process, except you had to be there at 8 a.m.
Or they were giving them out at 8 a.m., which means you had
to
be
there at 6 a.m.
at least.
Yeah. So, it's a terrible way to do it, because it's just too much pressure on people to have to get there that kind of early, and then they were making people wait out in the cold way too much. The one thing I will say is every day they got better about letting people in earlier and earlier and not making them wait outside in the cold as long. But it was still
I mean, they did. I do have to give them credit because I was super upset on Friday. Right. I was freezing. It was the coldest day of the con. It was really bad. And they did not let people in on time, which was another part of the problem. So, people have been outside. And I feel like this is the one caveat, of having this con in November is, look, you have no clue what it is going to be like. And if it had been one day earlier, there was a freak snowstorm happening. So, it would have been really, really bad to mm-hmm. be outside. But
it was the morning after the freak snowstorm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sucked to be out there that whole time.
And I do have, but I do have to give them credit that later that day, they sent a formal apology email that you got an update on your app about, like, we're so sorry for leaving you guys outside in the cold. You know, like, basically acknowledging that they screwed up and that they were going to do it differently on Saturday and Sunday. Luckily, I did not have to get autograph tickets on Saturday and Sunday, but, you know, had a friend who did, and it was did not go well. Even if you were getting there at, like, you know, 7:30, 7, it just wasn't happening. And I just, the other part that I didn't like about the way they did autograph tickets was that once you got that autograph ticket, there was literally nothing to do at the con for, like,
three hours.
So it was like, what am I supposed to do? Like, why is
this? Yeah, that was a really strange decision.
Like, I don't get, like, I guess on Saturday, yeah, because, like, on Saturday and Sunday, same thing. Like, the first thing that opens is the exhibitors hall. And if you got your autograph ticket at 8 a.m., the exhibitors hall doesn't open until 10. So you're just, yeah,
you're literally just, like, standing around. At least they let you stand around inside.
Yeah, I guess. I guess after all of that, you need to take a break. You just have to go sit somewhere.
Yeah, like on Friday, for me, because we were all there. It was like, and the other part was like, we were there, we were all going, we all attended his press. And so we get there, we get the autograph tickets, and then we got to stand around for 2 hours because we can't even pick up our badges yet. Because they just don't have that open yet. It's like, oh, we're all twiddling our thumbs. And then ultimately, like, for me, what I ended up doing was like, well, all right, we've been standing around for a couple hours. I guess I'm going to go stand around until they'll let me into the exhibit hall so I can go buy something I need to buy immediately to get another autograph ticket, of course. And then, yeah, so I ended up on Friday watching the, like, opening ceremony thing. Because that was right at the entrance to the exhibit hall, so I could kind of, like, stand right there and be like, the moment these guys say they're done, I can literally just dash into where I need to go and be done. Because I had to do that I had to dash. Exhibit hall opened at 1, so I had to dash into the exhibit hall, do what I needed to do, and then run back downstairs, because Torafura's autograph session was at 1:30. Hectic Friday.
And honestly, I think I really just prefer, like, hey, get in this autograph line 1 hour before this autograph session is supposed to happen, and, like, then you will get your autograph, or you won't. I don't know. Like,
there's a part of me that prefers ticketing.
Yeah?
Because I like knowing that I'm getting it or not, and just I can move on with my day. Like, it's like less anxious, less stressful to me in some ways. It's more stressful in the sense that I got to be there so damn early and all that bullcrap, but I assume the direction all this is going is pay up.
Well, because they do have paid, like, all the American voice actors is already paid.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, everyone, at least all the ones that were there.
They usually have, like, they'll have, like, a con-sponsored autograph session.
I think they had the Sailor Moon one this year. Yeah, that was, like,
a bunch of them. And then they've been doing it more and more, and it's very much a, like, Comic-Con style model thing where it's like, now we have a booth, and you come to my booth for these at these hours, and you can give me however much money, and I'll sign your thing.
Like, I'm not against, like, ticketing in the sense that, like, you're definitely getting it or you're definitely not getting an autograph, but I guess I just wish it was just closer to the time of the actual autograph set. I don't know, like,
yeah, there's, like, no good answer to this question.
No, everybody wants it done differently, and I get it, and I can see all the different ways that it could be done. I got my autograph, so, like, yeah, I've had a good year of autographs. All of my autograph karma is gone. It's depleted. I don't assume to have, like, this level of, like, luck. The other thing I will say about the ticketing thing, though, is that, and I don't blame people for doing this because, like, of course, but if you can get 2 tickets, a lot of people are like, well, since I'm here, I guess I'll get 2, as opposed to, like, here's what I really want.
Yeah, like, I actually did that. You know, where, like, I was like, oh, yeah, I'll totally go get Jam Projects, or, like, Kitadani and Kageyama's autograph. So I grabbed that extra ticket when I was getting the Tarafuria one, like, not thinking about, like, when that autograph session was or anything. And then I just ended up going, oh, well, I got something else I have to be at this exact same time, so I couldn't go anyway. And then I just have this ticket that no one gets to use, kind of thing.
And I feel like that probably happens a little bit more because...
Oh, I'm sure it does.
Like, just because, oh, well, I'm here and, like, I can or whatever.
I do wonder if, like, there should be, like, almost like a standby line. So, like, here's your ticket for the 1 o'clock autograph session. But if you couldn't get a ticket at 1 o'clock, we're going to let you guys line up in a standby line. And if we get through everything quick enough, their autograph session is an hour. So if they get through everything, they'll let you in. They're only obligated to do the ticketed ones. But maybe they can do some more kind of thing.
And I do feel like that's... Otakon doesn't do tickets, but that's kind of how they do their lines when they're not fucking them up deeply.
Like this year.
Is here's the line. We know, and they often actually do give you a ticket once you're in that line, like a just like, you know, like a raffle ticket kind of thing. And then they have the like
you're getting in.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, you guys can stay. Like, we're not kicking you out of the line, but we're not guaranteeing that they will get to like this part of the line. So yeah, I mean, I think that's reasonable. I don't know. Like, I don't get this year is just an anomaly that I don't tend to get a ton of autographs. So I feel like I have more feelings about it this year than I normally do because I was doing it so much, as opposed to a regular year. I'm like, yeah, I don't know.
Like, this is probably, I mean, this year's probably the most I've gotten in a year in a long time. Like, I'll usually get one or two, but I'm not the thing is, like, I'm not actually a super autograph guy.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's more like the opportunity to, like, meet the people that's more interesting to me than, like, this guy wrote on the thing. Unless it's something interesting and, you know, you can build it's a story that you got that autograph kind of thing. Or, like, you get something weird or, you know, like, there's more to it than just, like, this guy signed a thing. Yeah, you know, there's more, like, emotion connected to it. So I tend to be weirdly, like... I don't stress autographs, generally speaking, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, like, if I didn't get Toru Furuya's autograph, I'd be, like, a little disappointed, but I don't think it would have, like, ruined my day.
Yeah.
I'd have just been like, I guess I brought this, this perfect grade Gundam shield in my pocket for no reason. Oh, well.
Yeah, like, I already had his, like, I stressed about his autograph the first time I got it, which was, like, 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, but it's like, so I had it, so I wasn't as stressed about it this time. I was more stressed about getting Takuya Sato's autograph this time, but I really didn't need to be. that was literally the first thing I took, like, the second thing I took care of at the con, first thing being getting Toru Furuya's autograph ticket, second thing being going to the exhibit hall to get, to buy stuff from Pony Canyon to get another ticket. The thing there being, Takuya Sato was supposed to have autograph sessions all 3 days. Because of that freak snowstorm, his flight got canceled, and he actually only had one autograph session on Sunday, and his other two were canceled. Getting the ticket for his autograph session early was actually a really good thing in that regard, but it didn't seem like they ran out of them either.
I want to say that I'm not too cool for autographs or something, like... There are certain people who I won't go into, but if you've listened to this podcast, you'll probably easily guess that I would, you know, be having heart palpitations and like, can I get their autograph? Can I get their autograph? But a lot of people that even I really like, I'm usually pretty chill about if I get it or not. And even like when we went to Anime Next this year, the only reason I got autographs is because, like, someone asked me, hey, could you get in this line for autographs? I was like, ah, sure, all right, that seems fine.
I also, like I said, when we started talking about it, I don't tend to get a ton, so this year was an anomaly, but I will say I was pretty stressed about getting the Toru Furuya one because I really wanted it, I really like him, and I always want autographs to go in my Detective Conan book. And I, you know, my dream is to fill it up as much as possible. So when there's anybody significant that is from Conan, like, I really feel like, oh, I really want to get that. So I was very, very happy that we were able to get that. And of his panel spotlight was really good, it's too.
Very good.
And pretty full, like,
yeah.
Even though it was just called, like, Toru Furuya Spotlight or whatever.
Wasn't like, hey, it's Tuxedo Mask and maybe some other stuff, the Spotlight.
Oh, you know what? Did he get any Sailor Moon questions?
Well, he was on the Sailor Moon panel.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they focused on the Sailor Moon stuff there.
I was just trying to think if anybody asked him any.
He got a bunch of Gundam. He got the one Akagi.
And the, like, the moderator questions were all pretty, like, broad. He talked about Sailor Moon.
Yeah.
Because he talked kind of his whole career. His whole career. I don't know what the heck I just said.
There was at least one audience Saint Seiya question, wasn't there?
There was at least one Saint Seiya question. But yeah, he was on the Sailor Moon panel, so I'm sure, like, that's where the Sailor Moon talk was.
I wonder how many questions he got, because he was also with a lot of the American voice actors, and I feel that's like they tend to dominate for kind of obvious reasons in those scenarios.
Yeah, he was a really fun guest. Like, he's really fun at, like, he's really fun at conventions, because he seems like he's just having a good time with his fans. His spotlight panel had a lot of really fun questions, and, like, he had kind of a lot of play going on and goofing off and joking and stuff like that.
Like, the fact that he totally voices Ribbons, but he has this whole story about that's not him, it's like this younger voice actor he's mentoring, and he totally, as Pat's mentioned, has like a whole kayfabe about it.
Yeah, he doesn't break his kayfabe about whether or not he actually voiced Ribbons. And it's really funny because he's committed to it. It's like multiple times it came up during that panel and he did not budge an inch about Ribbons. It's like, yeah, I voiced the narrator in Gundam 00, but this other guy was Ribbons and he was really great.
The thing was, though, is that a lot of the audience did not get it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
They were just like, okay. Like, they were like, oh, okay. Like, they just not at all understanding.
Because it's a super nerd thing.
Well, like, and of course, like, every once in a while, you'll get a translator who knows, like, the works a lot. And in this case, I mean, the guy, you know.
That was a perfectly fine translator.
He was a good translator.
He didn't know the works.
And so, yeah, so I feel like if you get the person who does know it, then they can kind of, like, they can do, like, that humor can come across a little bit better, you know, like, in the translation. So I think that is always just can kind of be, like, a trouble spot with the translating. I thought the funniest parts were like, all Yamcha-san related. Yeah, like all that stuff was really good.
So, like, the guy that was an MC is a friend of mine, and I fed him, like, the best question of the panel. Which was, because Toa Furuya voices Yamcha, if you didn't know that. And so the question was, if you were reincarnated as Yamcha, what would you do? Because there's a manga where someone gets reincarnated as Yamcha. And his answer was, he would beat up Vegeta.
And he would win.
And he would win. He's like, the host was like, oh, you beat up Vegeta, would you win? He's like, of course.
And I like that he did the pose, like the dead Yamcha pose. And he also...
Because the dead Yamcha pose is like a weird meme now.
Yeah, and I like that he said he has like a figure of... Because I guess it's such a popular meme in Japan that they made a figure specifically. There is
like a fancy statue of dead Yamcha.
And so he has the figure of dead Yamcha. So like, I thought all that was like pretty great.
Yeah, and he also mentioned he has, like, some of his more iconic suits as models in his house, which is fun.
He seems like he really likes the new Gundam specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the one he brought up the most, was the new Gundam, I feel like.
I mean, when they had him do, what do you call it? You know, like, what's your, like, favorite line from, you know, shows you've done? And he was like, the new Gundam is not for show! So, you know...
Yeah, he only, like, said two lines the whole time, and it was, the new Gundam is not for show, and then the Akagi line.
Which is, like, some famous, like,
he's
Akagi
narrator.
Trick that he, like, sets somebody up, and it's like, I don't remember what it was, and, like, it involves some obscure Mahjong tile, which if you told me it 30 seconds ago, I wouldn't remember that.
Yeah, not a lot of people in the line, which was, so... The question line was massive.
Yeah.
Didn't get through it at all. But yeah, only two people asked him to, like, say stuff, which I feel like more... I feel like usually in voice acting panels, unless the voice actor specifically says, like, you can't ask me to do that, That's usually, like, I feel like the majority of questions are usually, like, say this.
Or like, because so, when I saw him at Anime Central, he had two panels. And both of them were really heavy in the, can you say the thing? But he was also, like, pushing it. Like, I'm ready. I'll say whatever thing you want. And he also, like, and I'm sure he had it at this con, too, and he just didn't get around to it. He has, like, on his phone, he has all of his famous lines prepared. He's like, oh, you want me to say a Saint Seiya thing? All right, I got that. Or you want me to say a, Gundam thing, or you want me to say a Detective Conan thing, or whatever the hell else he's done, Tuxedo Mask thing. Like, he'll just say all the things for you, and he's happy to do it, which is the other thing that's great about him, is he's really enthusiastic to do that shit for you.
I mean, yeah, he seemed just really game, you know, like, serious question, silly question. I feel like once I saw that he was game for silly questions, I was like, man, I wish I had asked a silly question, like, because there's so many.
I did ask him a Legend of Galactic Heroes question. I was lucky enough to do that one, and he mentioned about, because I asked him about Andrew Fork, because I felt it was a very different character than he usually plays. Yeah. And he's like, oh, yeah, that character's really despicable guy, really horrible. But he was like, the worst part of him was he just has these long soliloquies where he just spouts, you know, garbage at people. And I'd, like, look and I'd be like, oh, how many pages is this guy going to talk at once?
Because that's every character in Legend of the Galactic Heroes.
But I feel like Fork is, like, especially, like, just, like, garbage from the mouth soliloquies.
Yeah.
He's
not around for a super long time either, but it's like he talks a lot while he's there.
He does enough damage for the moments he is there.
He does a lot of damage. He's very bad.
So I thought that was... but once again, I felt like even when he was talking about that, he seemed really like upbeat and fun about it.
Yeah, he's very clearly a guy that just has fun going to these things. Because he goes to them a lot.
Well, you say that, but this is the first time I've ever gotten to see him.
First time me.
So... yeah. East Coast.
I mean, he was at Anime Boston last year. He was on the East Coast, so.
I guess so. Well, it's first
the problem is he hasn't gone to Otakon. That's what you're
asking. Damn it!
Mean.
Just go to Otakon.
They should go to Otakon and just have... they should have Toru Furia says things as a panel.
Yeah.
Just go in and say, like, hey, can you say a Saint Seiya thing?
I would be into that. Sounds fun.
Yeah, that would rule. I want to go to that panel really bad.
Shane's just like, here's this Detective Conan script. I'll do the other parts.
Definitely probably one of my favorite voice acting guests that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. So, like, very, very happy. And, like... you know, he's been in the business a long time. I feel like I learned at this panel, you know, his, like, breakout role is his role in Star of the Giants.
Right.
But he was 15 when he did that. Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Right, that's insane! And that wasn't even his first role. That was just, like, his, like, really big, like, moment at the beginning of his career. So, like, that's ridiculous. And, yeah, you know, and he did get a little, like, there were a couple, like, melancholy moments, because he did say, like, him, and then, of course, he has known the voice actor for Char for, like, forever, and they spend a lot of time together voice acting, but he was like, oh, you know, like, we won't be around forever, like,
yeah.
I was like, no, but he needs to come, too, like, you should have brought him with you.
I mean, Kate is older than him. Well, a decent amount. Shuichi Ikeda is, I think, like 10 years old.
I thought you said Kate. I was like, I am?
The voice of Shaw. Shuichi Ikeda is a bit older.
Kate, you are the writer of the tomb, not the voice.
I'm not the voice of Shaw.
You are not the voice of Shaw.
He's older than
he is older. Yeah, he's a bit older. I think he's had some health problems, too.
No! I mean, I know this happens, but no!
Yeah.
So all the people, all the older people, they all need to come at the same time to Otakon. Just everybody.
Just bring the entire cast of Gundam that's still alive.
Yes, and then also could you just, like, on your way, just pick up Norio Wakamoto, just like,
yeah,
on a, as too. A side thing.
Yeah.
Just bring Kate, just bring everybody who was a voice actor in Legend of Galactic Heroes in one con.
Perfect.
I mean, that's like 70% of the industry, but whatever.
Yeah. Every famous dude that's ever voiced something in anime is in that damn show.
But that was, like, the only guest. Is that the only guest I went? I think that's the only guest I really went
to see
at the con. And then when I was at certain screenings, they had, you know, they just happened to have some, like, at the Great Kasei San and Morning Glory's movie screening, they had the director and the producer. And were you guys, you weren't there when they first started talking about him, but they were like, he has not, like, doesn't show his face ever on the internet. So it was like, you cannot take photo, you can't do anything. Like,
did you go to the Letter B live drawing?
Oh yes, of course. Yeah. Thank you. I did go see. Yeah. Did you go to the range?
No, drawing? I didn't. It was against the concert, I think.
Oh, okay.
So I did not go to the range one. I heard the range one was good, though.
And I was,
but they both had a lot of technical issues with those stupid projector things.
And I was going to go to it, but then you informed me that they had the Lupin anniversary screening. So I ditched that to go to see Lupin.
Yeah, that was really fun. That was another screening that was, like, unexpected. And I just go back to live drawing for a second. I really love that that is the new trend at cons, because it's just watching artists do what they're good at is just so fun.
Mm-hmm.
And since, unfortunately, most of, like, the artists that come don't have, like, tables in Artist Alley or something where you can, like, go and see them working.
Yeah.
It's such a great idea. I love those types of panels. When they're not having technical issues. Yeah.
My only problem with the Letter B one, and I think you had the same problem, was I was a little sleep deprived, and that guy likes to draw to very soothing music, and I just, like, I, like, passed out for, like, 5 minutes at one point, because it being Sunday morning, me kind of being worn out, and then the soothing music, I, like, just noticed, whoa, I'm full asleep there for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how any of you guys were functioning, because
I don't know how I function.
You all got home later than me, pretty much, like, every night.
Friday night, I got home at 4 a.m.
And yet we're up
with you
at the same time. I was like, how are you guys awake?
So Friday night, I got home at 4 a.m. Got up. It was leaving for the con with you on Saturday morning. When did we leave? Like 8:30?
No, 9:45.
Whatever. It felt like 8:30. I think I got up at 8:30. And then we left at 9:45. Did the whole day at the con. Went to the concert for 3 hours with, you know, screaming and glow stick waving, and got out of said concert, literally ran from the Hammerstein back to the convention center to see the Kasei-san movie, and then went out until like 2 a.m. And then got back up and with you in the morning on Sunday. I don't know how I survived. I'm not know how I didn't get sick, knock on cardboard. Wood, that's kind of wood-ish. But I somehow survived this convention.
Yeah, everybody was partying real hard. Not me.
Well, yeah, no, it caught up to me in that Letter B panel.
Yeah.
And it was fine. It would have been fine, but it was the combination of him being very soft-spoken and then him playing that soothing music, and just at, like, one point in a lull, I know I passed out for, like, 5 minutes.
Yeah, I weirdly, like, didn't pass out at this con on Sunday, like, because that happens to me a lot.
Because then you stayed out on Sunday.
I went to karaoke on Sunday. I went to karaoke on Sunday and then went out for dinner and then came back and had to get up for work in the morning and did it. I don't know how. And I felt okay. I don't know. I literally have no idea how I didn't feel like garbage on Monday morning. But
that's the power of Toraphoria.
That's the power of Kageyama. That dude sang heats. Like, that concert ruled. So
you've been to the Anisong concerts before,
yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Do you feel like this was the best one? Or, like, there's been, what, there was one at Otakon?
Last year at Otakon, there was one. So since it's been this formal Anisong World Matsuri thing, It's been at AX the past 3 years. Last year was Otakon, and then this year Otakon didn't have it, and then Anime NYC had it. So I went to Otakon's. Otakon's was better because it was Jam Project and TMR.
It was the full...
It was Jam Project and TM Revolution. Like, no offense to anybody that was on this show, including two members of Jam Project. But TMR is extremely powerful, and so is, like, the entire Jam Project as a group. So it's like, that wins, that beats almost anybody.
And as someone who went to it, it was a pretty rocking concert.
Yeah.
Me and Vega had a grand old time.
Yeah, exactly. It was a great-ass show. This show, so I didn't go the first night. The first night had Nano and True and Luna Haruna and other idol girls or something or other. I know that many of them somehow. The one I went to was the Saturday night concert, which was Hironobu Kageyama. He's like the leader of Jam Project, a legitimate like legend in the industry. You know, he sang all the Dragon Ball Z songs. He's the leader of Jam Project, all that kind of stuff. Hiroshi Kitadani, who's another member of Jam Project, who's most famous for singing We Are, We Go, and We Can, three of the One Piece openings. Shokutan Shoko Nakazawa, who is famous for
cats,
smelling cat butts,
putting cats in her mouth, putting cat heads in her mouth, smelling their butts. She sang the opening to Gurren Lagann. She sang the version of Pegasus Fantasy for Saint Seiya Omega, which is relevant to this concert. And then Morning Musume 1-8. Because I found out it's pronounced 1-8, not 18, for some reason. Because it's a Japanese thing, I guess. And they like doing that. So, it's still a very, very good lineup. And they did, you know, a lot. Everyone did a bunch of solo stuff. It opened with Kageyama and Kitadane doing Go, which is like the fourth opening to Naruto. It's the Fighting Dreamers. It's the flow song. Which is like, hey, we opened with the Nart song. It's like, cool. Everyone, you know, gets real excited. And then Kitadani did his stuff. He did a bunch of, like, he did all his One Piece songs, and he covered one or two Jam Project songs. He did his stuff. Then Shokutan came out. She did her stuff. She covered Cruel Angel's Thesis, which was cool. That's like a go-to for these kind of concerts. And then she did Sororia Days, her Gurren Lagann song. And I remember at the end of that one, I was like, oh man, she's not going to do Pegasus Fantasy. I really wanted to hear Pegasus Fantasy live. And then Kitadani comes out, because he's actually covered Pegasus Fantasy a ton too. Like, I saw a solo show with him and he covered it there. And they sang Pegasus Fantasy together. I was like, hell yeah, this concert rules. There's nothing that's going to top this. And then Morning Musume comes out. Does their act. I know none of their songs, more or less. They did their act. They were great, you know, great dancing and performance. They're like great performers, you know, that kind of thing. They've been, as a, like, the group has existed for a million years, though, you know, the members change regularly. And then Kageyama comes out and does Love Machine with them, which was great, because he comes out and he's like, I can't dance like them. Because, you know, he's like a man in his 50s. He's been doing this for a very long time. So, like, they're still doing their elaborate karaoke all around him, and he's doing, like, an old man shimmy kind of in the middle of the stage, like, you know, kind of bopping back and forth as they're all doing this crazy dancing, and he's singing along with them. And then they sing along. They do Chala Hechala, the first Dragon Ball song, Dragon Ball Z opening, with him. And that's like, that's the cool thing about it. They did all these like transition things between the acts. So they did that with him, and that was a transition into him doing his stuff. And then they did Chala Hechala together, and then he did We Got a Power, which is the second opening to Dragon Ball Z. And then he did We Were Angels. So for me, and I'm getting done with this soon. So for me, like, I was like, holy shit, Pegasus Fantasy. Nothing's going to top this. And then he sings, and then Child Hitchala. It's like, okay, cool. He always sings that. And then he sings We Got a Power. It's like, hey, that's cool. He doesn't sing that as often. He's doing two Dragon Ball Z songs. That's really cool. Then he sings We Were Angels, which is my favorite Dragon Ball Z song. And I was like, holy shit, this rules. This is the best concert ever. Nothing's going to top this. And then he does, like, a acoustic set. So he does a song with Shokutan, and then he does an acoustic cover of Real Folk Blues, which is okay. And then he sings Heats, which is the opening to Get a Robo Armageddon. It's like, holy shit, what is happening now? This concert is insane. This rules so hard.
The walls of reality are crumbling down.
It was so good.
He could have just went, all right, concert over. Fuckers.
And the way they closed the concert is everyone came out and sang the hero, the One Punch Man theme together. And that's how they closed the concert. So, yeah, great show. Really, really fun. Hammerstein's a good venue for that kind of stuff, too, so.
Yeah, now that you brought up, though, it made me think about, you know, where this convention might be headed, which I don't love, is that I think all musical stuff this year was an extra
fee. Yes, it was all ticketed.
So, like, last year, the Thunderbolt, I almost said Thunderbolt Fantasy because of Al now. The Gundam Thunderbolt was not an extra fee. That was just part of your ticket last year.
But they sold a VIP.
They did, which is I'm fine with.
Yeah.
But all of the concerts this year, you could not go unless you bought an extra ticket.
That is, so the one thing with the Matsuri is, the Anisong World Matsuri, you could buy tickets to independently of the convention. You didn't have to go to the convention to go to those concerts. Not that, like, I mean, you know, the majority of people did that. But the Matsuri is like this weird kind of gray area where it's part of the convention, but not 100% part of the convention. But you are right. None of the concerts were free at this convention.
And there were, like, I'm just wondering, you know, I know that has become pretty typical at AX, that there's, like, a lot of extra ticketed events, mm-hmm. not just musical stuff. Yeah. I don't remember exactly. I've never been, so.
Yeah. And look, the cosplay is an additional price.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, not that I would go, but yeah. So I just wonder, you know, and we did see, so this year there was regular tickets, there was general admission tickets, there were mega tickets, there were VIP tickets. You know, I'm wondering if we're getting towards sort of like a more nickel and diming kind of
and I think, event. I think we kind of are. I think a lot of cons are going that way, unfortunately.
Because I didn't go to the Fate event. Because I basically went, all right, I'm gonna roll some dice here. If I can get in free as press, I'll go see it. But if I don't, I'll just see what other stuff is going on. And they didn't let any press in. It was considered a separate ticketed event, and you needed to buy a ticket. And I was fine with that. But I was like, it does lend credence once again to this whole idea that there are going to be a bunch of sections that are basically, you know, are you going to pony up the cash for these? Because even at Expo, like, I think there are a bunch of things where you can buy the ticket to guarantee yourself a seat. But if there's still free seats, you can go. Some of the concerts, but not all the concerts like that. I think the Masquerade is like that. Basically, people with Masquerade tickets go in first. And then, basically, if you don't want to pay for the Masquerade, I think you go in after basically all the ticketed people.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that we saw Kageyama in the hall and got to wave to him.
Oh, yeah. He reminded me of that. At the beginning of the convention.
That was the one good thing about getting there when we had nothing to do and we were there so early. He was just wandering around. Yeah. So that was cool, I guess.
And I got to wave to him a second time when he was just, you know, hanging out at the convention, you know, on his way to something or other.
I do feel like the con is still small enough where you get to you'll see the guests around a little bit, which is always kind of fun. Just, like, see them out in the wild. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Artist Alley. Pat's got to have his soliloquy, so. So last year, it was, like, one of the best Artist Alleys I'd ever been to. I think the space is super great for it and makes it feel, like, so nice. Like, there's just something really nice about that space.
You can imagine it's, like, the top floor of the convention center, which is, like, got all the cool glass, like, roof windows and stuff. And
so it's got all the best light
in
the convention center. I do feel like it's, you know, kind of at capacity, so. Like,
it felt pretty crowded at times.
Yeah, so it's like, if they want it to ever get bigger, it's gonna have to move, which would be really sad.
So, I foolishly went to the exhibit hall and tried to get the free pins for people, and so a lot of things had, like, you have to find X number of, basically, employees that are either dressed as Starlight Review characters or dressed like prisoners from Golden Kamuy. And, like, because I foolishly did it on Saturday, I was kind of drained. So I was like, all right, I did most of it. I like got all the Starlight ones, and I got 3 out of 4 for the Golden Kamuy. I'll relax. I'll go to Artist Alley. And if I was Kate, I would have known what a foolish idea it was. Because when I got into Artist Alley on Saturday evening, it was just a sea of humanity. And it, like, by the time I went from the front to the back, I just went back up front. And then I just left and I just went to, because I usually went to dinner after the convention, but that like drained me so much that I just had to like step away from the convention for a little while and just like get a burger and like decompress. And then I went back to the con and I was fine. And enjoyed the rest of the evening. But it was packed on Saturday to the point where, like, I don't usually get that much crowd anxiety, but it did feel like it did get to me a little bit.
So you actually mentioned brought up two things that I want to talk about more. So in the exhibit hall, the finding people to get a prize thing. So, like, that is, like, the trend. I mean, there was at least 3 of those going on. Maybe there were more. I'm not sure. And and if you want to get me to participate in those, this con knew how to do that because they involved buttons and or pins in a couple of them. So,
favorite things.
Good job. I will absolutely do your little quest. At first, I was really annoyed that I had to do this stupid quest. I really just wanted to give you my money because I will buy things from you.
I'll give you $10 for these.
Yeah, it's like, really? You don't want my... All right, fine. But then I actually kind of had fun doing it. So, fine. Like, it was just something at least, like, entertaining to do in the exhibitors hall and, like, just like a little game to play. So I actually really enjoyed that, and I like that as a trend. It seems to be very, very popular, so it seems like everybody else is on board with it. And then I wanted to mention my tip, which I told Al after he had this horrible experience, which is, so the Exhibitors Hall and the Artist Alley work almost like inverse of each other. So in the morning, first thing in the day, the Exhibitors Hall is the busiest because that's the first thing everybody goes to as soon as they get there. And the Artist Alley is the least busy at the beginning of the day. And then they switch. So, like, later in the day, you'll have plenty of room in the Exhibitors Hall, and then everybody has, like, finished at the Exhibitors Hall, and they're like, all right, I'm done with that. Where do I go next? I'm going to go to Artist Alley. I think because of what Pat said, especially at this con, because they filter you directly to the Exhibitors Hall, that's even more of the case, because that's actually what they're trying to do, is to get you to go there first. So I think it was felt even more at this con. The Artist Alley itself was just high level. Very impressed with the variety of work up there. A lot of people selling their own books, zines and original work. So I felt like I saw a lot of that.
Yeah, there. I was really impressed by the quality of everything at this con. Like, in the Artist Alley, I mean. It was all really good.
And, like, I feel like there were less crafts that, like, at Otakon, I think I see a lot more crafts. Here, I see a lot more books and zines than I see at Otakon. So I don't know if that's just, you know, that's just who's around. I do think that Anime NYC is still very much a local con, even though it grew so much from one year to the next. I think it's still mostly people from the general area.
I think this year was the year that more people inside of New York City learned or like were like, I guess I'll go this year, as opposed to like getting a whole influx of people from like the tri-state or
I mean they were spent the they Northeast. Spent a lot of time talking about how many people traveled to this con this year. That was a big thing they were pushing. So I think it's actually the inverse of that.
Oh, really?
Where it was more or less like tri-state area people last year, and this year everyone heard how good last year was and more people traveled. I know more people that traveled to this con this year than last year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, that's what it's going to take to grow it.
Yeah.
Is if people are willing. I mean, I think flying into New York City the weekend before Thanksgiving sounds terrible to me. Yeah. But, like, You do you. Like,
it's 2 weeks before Thanksgiving next year.
Okay. Oh, they announced next year? I didn't even see that they announced the dates. That's better. I think that's
Thanksgiving's
better.
Late next year, I think, is the reason, though.
And it's early this year, yeah. So... But whatever combination of people that are coming, you know, I think that the Artist Alley feels different from, like, when I go to Otakon. So just the variety of things, I think, is slightly different. But I saw a few people that I always see, but I saw a lot of new stuff too. So I was glad to see whatever. So I assume they're doing a lottery system. I think most places that's how they do the artist alleys now.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So, I felt like there was a good, you know, balance of people. I bought a lot more prints than I normally do, and the last thing I will say is the new item that seems to be on the rise is patches. I've saw a lot of them, and I fully expect that to grow a little bit more. I love patches. I actually don't put patches on things, but I love collecting them because I love embroidered, like items like that. They're just so, like, the tactile nature of that I love. So I think that's a really cool item to have. Of course, there are still tons of enamel pens and other types of pen stuff, but I feel like patches is the new, or it's not new, but it has gone to a little bit of an ascendance at the moment.
Well, everyone's moving away from enamel pins now, so they need new things.
I think we're on a slight downward trajectory for the enamel pins.
I think they were too expensive.
I mean, patches are pretty expensive. The patches I saw, people are charging a pretty hefty amount for them, but I think they might be cheaper to make.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The enamel pins are pretty expensive to make, and you have to make a lot of them for them to be affordable.
So my question is always, what did you see a lot of? What was, like, the cool things? And was there anything that had taken a dive from last year, or at least since Otakon?
So I think I saw more My Hero Academia here than I saw at Otakon. Like, it was so much. And
it was a lot.
It was dominant in a way that at Otakon, I felt like there were two or three things that felt dominant. We're here, absolutely, like, beyond all things. And even in cosplay, too, it was like, no. Like, it was so dominant. And the some weird things that I saw. So one booth, the women there, I think everything they had was Yu-Gi-Oh! So I was like, wow! Like half of the booth was like all Yu-Gi-Oh! Stuff. Very impressed. I saw at least three people who had something Ranma, which I thought was just so random. And I was like not expecting that at all.
You know what I think it is? You asked me before, and I was actually, these are the things that just keep me, I think it's because they're reissuing the Ranma books, like, with the Lum books. So that might be the only thing that I could think might be a research. I think they're also...
It's the anniversary year, too, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think last year was the anniversary year. And I think they're also re-releasing the DVDs, so I think they're putting it back.
I mean, that all is last year stuff, though. Mm-hmm. It's not this year's. It's, and honestly, it's 2 years ago stuff, really. I think it's just, like, another generation looking at Rumiko Takahashi stuff again. Especially, like, Ranma. Ranma's very aesthetic kind of thing. Whatever the hell that even means, I'm the one that said it. So I think, like, there's, like, an attraction to, like, Ranma's aesthetic and Lum's aesthetic specifically, like...
I wish I had seen Lum stuff. I didn't see anything like that.
Well, that's getting reissued next year, so maybe we'll see some Lum stuff in a year or two.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely... If there was one thing I'd love to see more of overall is, like, more, like, retro... Not only stuff, but style, which I just a couple of people, but not too much. I don't think we see that very much. And I also wanted to say that I saw a decent amount of JoJo's Part 5, despite it only really just starting. I didn't buy any JoJo's Part 5 stuff because I don't even know, like, who my favorite character is yet. Like, I haven't even fully met every character.
Is that the guy behind the wall in the prison cape?
No, I think I can definitively say not him, but otherwise, not unsure, unclear. So I was kind of like, oh, you guys are like just too ahead of me because I don't know like what my feelings are about this. But I did see overall, like, yeah, more than I was expecting just because it only recently started. And then like, a smattering of other JoJo stuff still around. But I seem to have ticked up just a little bit now that part 5 is back because it seemed to kind of like, all right, you know, we're like simmering about JoJo now.
This won't be for like a year or two at minimum, but I'm really curious when Stone Ocean comes out. I assume that's just going to blow Artist Alley the hell up.
Every
new season of JoJo's does this. It's like, I feel just, like, this is a conversation that happens with every new JoJo. Like, man, this new JoJo is going to be real popular. It's like, yeah, they're all fucking popular because it's a really popular series. And it's like, it's been tailor-made for the U.S. from the beginning. It's just never had access. And now that they finally made the damn cartoon of the whole thing, it's like the audience found it. The audience was always there for JoJo's. It's just, it was waiting for its opportunity, and they finally gave it. Like, I don't, yeah.
The only thing that I will say why I think Stone Ocean is different is how much part, now that you've at least seen some of the, you've seen all the main characters of, other than Trish, who you'll meet a little later on. You've seen most of the main characters of part 5. How much did you see their cosplay before this point? You've seen like one or two of them. But Jolene, every con since JoJo has started, I've seen a Jolene somewhere.
And I always see stuff of her in Artist Alley, even though that part is not out. So people are highly anticipating.
Like when Steel Ball Run comes out, I'm sure it will be the hotness when it comes out. I feel like Jolene in particular just has this thing among, I feel like, especially with cosplayers and people in Artist Alley, that will make it blow up a little more than previous parts. But yes, it will. It is almost, inevitably going to be the king or queen when it comes out. I just feel like Stone Ocean has a little more push.
Okay, so we all went to a decent amount of screenings. Mm-hmm. So what were people feeling? What did they like?
So I'm going to save the other screening I went to for Pat's because that's his baby. But I really enjoyed the Lupin special. It was only 15 minutes, but I thought it was really great because it's like a companion piece to Lupin Part 5. Because a big part of Lupin Part 5, as I've said this a bunch of times, but I think it really sums up Lupin Part 5 really well, is Lupin Part 5 asks the question, is Lupin still relevant? And of course, it's a Lupin series. The answer is yes. But I feel like a lot of it is the examination of the Lupin gang, the examination of, you know, how much technology has changed. And yet, in many ways, Lupin, up until recently, has remained a very classical phantom thief, you know, a classical gentleman thief. So a lot of that was like an examination of the history, especially since it's a big anniversary year. And that was such a big focus of the TV show. And they did it in a way that I thought was very fun and, you know, had just like a Lupin sense of whimsy. But it, you know, it had like, it touched on all of Lupin's big villains. And I think it was just a fun little clever piece that I think was exactly what I needed for that anniversary. Oh, and Kate, Mr. X was in there because he's the only villain that was in multiple times in Green Jacket and Red Jacket. And he's the only villain that was in both of those long-running series.
Yeah, it was a very fun short. Very funny. Had some really, like, great laugh out loud moments. Had a little sentimental moment too. Mm-hmm. So I think it seemed like a really nice, it was like, it was a nice, like, fun. And it was 50th anniversary. Like, wow.
Yeah, that's definitely a thing I would like to see at some point.
So they said it's going to be on the DVD release.
The DVD and Blu-ray will have that bundle in.
Which DVD? The Part 4?
Part 5.
Oh, I didn't know they said they were putting out Part 5 yet.
If they didn't, they essentially announced...
I mean, maybe they mean, like, in Japan?
Yeah, that might be the Japanese Blu-ray release. Hopefully, I mean, I'm sure if and when Discotech does it, they'll do everything in their power to get this as well.
Yeah.
So, especially since it seems like it's more or less a companion piece to Part 5 anyway.
Should we talk about Gundam Narrative?
That was weird. Did you go to Gundam Narrative?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were all there.
Yeah, I couldn't remember. That was weird. That was not the first 20 minutes of that movie.
Okay, yeah, we were trying to figure this out because I was definitely a little bit confused by this, the what felt like time skipping around. I was like, is this being told in a linear way? Yeah. I'm like,
I feel like
in a way it was kind of linear, but
it was linear.
But the problem is the time jumps are not, or at least in that version, are not extremely, like, you just, oh, they're older now. I guess time has passed. I suppose I can figure out by guesstimating how old they are, but you could give me a little help here, show.
So, they said it was the first 20 minutes of the movie. It definitely wasn't the first. It felt like it wasn't the first 20 minutes of the movie. It was 20 minutes of the movie.
We hope, right?
Yeah, yeah. Otherwise, this movie's really just jointed and weird, which could very well be the case. It's 80 minutes trying to cover this story. And it's one movie. It's not like it's going to be a bunch of them like Unicorn was. It felt like, to me, they cut a bunch of talky bullshit out to get to the action. Because it was a pretty heavy, action-heavy thing.
Yeah, because I think the one that threw me off the most was, there's that part where they're sort of, like, chasing down that scientist woman, and they're, like, gonna kidnap her or whatever, and, like, force her to do something, and then they're like, we've got you! And then it's, like, times, it's, like, just skips to, like, some complete other thing that's happening.
That's the lady who, the remaining member of the Vist family, the bad guys from Unicorn, the one that they capture at the end, mm-hmm. who doesn't die or commit suicide, that was that lady.
Yeah.
I mean, thank you, because I didn't know who that lady was, but I wasn't confused about who she was. Like, I was just like, okay, we've done that, we've gone, and we're gonna do this thing, and then that, like, is never brought up, like then it skips, yeah. and then they never circle back to, like, what that was about. So I was like, wait, what? Like, okay, that lady, I don't know. Anyway,
this movie is, or like what we've seen of it, it's very disjointed.
But that just, might not be the real,
that's not thing. Might not be the real movie. So it's worth noting they screened this like a week or so before it actually comes out in Japan. And it's like this weird sequel to Unicorn. It's more or less Unicorn episode 8. With these new, a bunch of new characters you've never seen before, but they were there the whole time.
Okay, one quick question that I'm just, I keep forgetting to ask it, but I'm going to ask it on the podcast for no reason. Did they always mention that the Phoenix, or is that, oh, you didn't know that there was another Hokuten brother?
The Phoenix has been known.
Okay.
It's not like they didn't invent it for this movie.
Okay.
There was a G-Dome short back at Diver City, like where the Gundam was, where the life-size Gundam was, or where the Unicorn is now. Before they remodeled it, they had this, like, dome show, and one of the shorts in the dome show was called One of 72. Hold on, I'm going to actually make sure I'm getting this right, because if Tom listens to this, he'll give me shit. 1 of 72.
This is deep nerd stuff, guys.
Is that the right one? That's the question. Yeah, it was Gundam UC, 1 of 72. And it's like, it was like a G-Dome short about the Phoenix. And the Banshee shows up in it too. I actually saw it when I was in Japan, because I went there and we happened to be there at the perfect time to see all the G-Dome shows. Here's the reason I bring this bit up is the G-Dome's gone. Like, they remodeled everything when they put up the unicorn, and they got rid of that, apparently. I think that's the first time it shows up. And there's, like, a short story that was written called Phoenix Hunt, which is what this movie is based on.
Okay, because
there was definitely, like, there were three unicorns, and, like, that's more or less established thing. It's not something they made up for this movie,
basically. Okay, because I was, like, I remember the two unicorns from Gundam Unicorn, and I'm, like, that was, like, did I just forget that they mentioned that this is the third one? It's not going to show up here. He's not appearing in this film.
It really funny that you just said that there are three unicorns, but one of those unicorns is a phoenix. Like, it's just like,
the second one's a banshee.
I was just pointing out that it's like a different mystical beast. Yes. Like,
they're all the unicorns, but they all have different, like, names. And, like, the first one's the actual unicorn, and then there's the banshee, and then there's the phoenix. So, yeah. But, yeah, it's more or less been a known thing. There have been model kits of it in the past. It's the cool gold one. It's cool, I guess. I'm actually not super into the unicorn as a design. So, me personally, but it's doing more unicorn stuff. It seems like it's kind of set up for stuff they're doing in the future and all that kind of stuff.
Like, I feel like if I'm going to watch this, I need to rewatch Unicorn, just because I also slept through a lot of Unicorn because I find it kind of boring. But,
I mean, that's why you didn't remember that Vist lady.
Yeah, I probably just slept through a scene. I definitely slept through lots of that OVA. So, I probably need to, you know, study up. But I feel like I didn't come away with a real good sense
of what the hell it is.
Maybe I understand what it is, especially once they told me that, like, the phoenix went missing for a year, and it's sort of just like almost like this thing that shows up like a shooting star, and you have to, like, maybe you can catch it, maybe you can't, which that kind of bit sounds kind of interesting to me. That wasn't really clear to me personally during the 20 minutes. But once the rest of the panel was them talking about the character designs and the mecha designs and stuff like that. And so I was like, okay, like, I think the thing that actually, which has nothing to do with this movie itself, and then, of course, we're recording this after they announced the 40th anniversary projects for Gundam, which we won't get into now because it's not relevant, but at this panel, they were like, we hope to release a movie, a Gundam movie, every 1 to 2 years, and I was like, quality over quantity, guys. Yeah. Let's just stop a little bit. Like,
I mean, that's more or less the pace that they did with Unicorn. Actually, that's slower than they did with Unicorn. So it's not that crazy.
I guess when I hear movie, it's actually a little bit different, because I feel like in Japan, you know, like, some anime movies are like an hour as opposed to, like, when I hear the word, I think it's because when I hear the word movie, I think a little bit of a bigger production than what they're actually talking about.
So Gundam Narrative is, technically speaking, the first theatrical UC Gundam movie since F91. Like, because the Unicorn stuff doesn't count, because those were actually all OVAs. Though they were screened in theaters, too.
See, yeah, I was considering those OVAs, not movies.
So, they're doing this, and it seems like, I assume they're all going to be more or less of, like, Unicorn kind of level quality. Like, Unicorn, the origin level quality type stuff. Which is, like, good, but not incredible. Like, very good for most studios, but not, like, mind-blowing. Actually, don't care for a lot of the Unicorn aesthetic. I don't want to get too deep into it, but it's like, yeah, it's, y'all are making a lot of Gundam now. Man, it's a lot of Gundam now. Maybe chill out a little bit.
It just seemed like a lot. Especially because they said UC specifically, I guess. So
yeah, because it's this, like, big, like, it's like their big project now with UC is, like, everything post-Unicorn, basically. So
Right. And it always seemed like they were staying away from that weird time in between when basically UC turns into F-91 as almost like this no man's land, and they seem to be diving headlong into that section now.
I think because they've just, like, been digging in the other sections for too long, and they need a bigger, like, easier playground, so they don't have to worry about how it fits in with the one-year war anymore if they do it this way. All they gotta do is be careful when they get close to F-91 to not be too, like, screwy. Because ultimately, like, the only parts of Gundam that are, like, as hard in canon as something in Gundam can be is the animated stuff, right? So that's the only thing they gotta work around is other animated stuff. And if you just go to where they're a big-ass chunk of however many years in the timeline where there isn't anything else, you can do whatever the hell you want, kinda.
You hit the wall of, you have to have the big incident with Iron Mask and F-91, and then eventually you'll hit victory.
Yeah, you got holes. You got big-ass holes you can fill.
And, you know,
hey,
Despite the insistence upon it, you really don't have to address everything just because you set things in between such and such. You don't have to actually address everything that ever happened in Gundam history. I'd much rather they
didn't address every damn thing.
Like, don't worry about it. Like,
that's a big part of why I don't really care for Unicorn, because it feels like it's just trying to fill in holes that you didn't need to fill in. And it's like jerking off to Char too much.
Well, we've kind of discussed this. And we'll move on to other things shortly. But it also does seem like this weird trying to make the UC that Tomino made make perfect sense when Tomino has never cared that the UC make perfect sense.
Where it's almost like the more you put in it, the more, like, if there being such huge holes actually allows it to make sense. Mm-hmm. But if you try to fill it all in, I feel like it actually makes it feel like it makes less sense. Mm-hmm. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Look like what I just said.
The UC as it currently stands thrives on the large amount of ambiguity the minute that...
Well, not anymore. I feel like they've already filled it and so much of it, but...
Well, like, I guess the transition from standard UC to victory has still been rather ambiguous. The only thing is, like, the only hard fixed point is F-91, and I guess to a certain degree Crossbone.
There's an enormous amount of Crossbone too. But yeah, Gundam's dumb.
But we like it anyway.
I love it. Most of it. Unicorn's okay. Jirako's better than Unicorn. It probably is a really controversial statement. It's true.
That's right. I'd definitely rather watch Klim do anything than watch Unicorn. So
Exactly.
So I just want to bring up one screening that I went to. I didn't get to see the whole thing, but I did go to the Natsume Eugene Cho movie. And I wish I could have stayed for the whole thing. I just couldn't. It was kind of late in the evening. They gave out blind box bookmarks to everybody who came to the movie. And I was with somebody, so we got two. And they got Yanko Sensei, which was great. And then I got my ship. So I was like, okay, we've got the two best bookmarks possible from this. I am now content. The movie was really fun so far. I saw about an hour of it, and this is actually like a full length movie. It's a 2-hour movie. So the premise is a normal Natsume. If you're familiar with Natsume Eugene Cho, it's like not any different, so far. And I was kind of trying to figure out what about this story is so big that it needed 2 hours as opposed to, cause the TV show is very episodic. Could this have been a TV show? So I, like, not clear to me why that was. Here's your selling point for the movie, not that you needed one, but, Nyanko Sensei brings home, accidentally, like, gets the seed on him, brings home, and they're, like, a weird, creepy giant tree grows in the yard, but, like, nobody can see it unless you have sort of, like, the second sight kind of thing. And instead of being cautious, he just eats the fruit on the tree because he's a glutton, and the fruit makes him explode into 3 different cats, and so they're all, like, little baby, like, kitten Yanko Sensei's running around in this movie. That was pretty much, like, the stuff. That was, like, what they were talking about at the beginning, like, from the producer and stuff. Like, hey, there's 3 little Yanko Senseis, and everyone everyone's like, yes, this is exactly what I wanted. So that was, like, very funny. And, of course, we do get to learn a lot about Reiko and her past in here. So that might be the thing that's like, oh, we're spending a lot more time telling you kind of more about the grandmother. And maybe that's why it's 2 hours. So really looking forward to seeing the rest of the movie. But, you know, it was as great as everything that you've already seen, if you're familiar with it.
It's so. All the hardcore sex in the second half that you missed.
I left at the wrong time.
Well, you gotta know where the Nyanko Sensei babies come from.
I do think that because Natsume Yujincho, it is such an episodic series, I think if you've never seen the series, you could watch the movie. They explain at the beginning what Natsume's Book of Friends, like, what that means and how it works and, like, the general premise. They do kind of, like, recap that a little bit in the show, in the movie, so you could watch it without knowing. And that screening was packed, which I was really, like, impressed with, so.
I think the only one that might have gotten more people was probably that Mob Psycho premiere.
The Mob Psycho premiere that I did not get into, that was, like, the one screening.
That was mobbed!
Leave.
Did you go to that?
No, I just saw, like, the huge line, and I was like, it's not worth it. Yeah. I'll see it when we do the SWAT review.
When you saw that huge line, you were not getting in, because I was like, there's a huge line, that's fine, I will go. And they were like, no, this line is closed.
I know, I was there, like, I randomly was there about an hour and a half before, or was it already closed by then?
That, I don't know.
I was there an hour and a half, and it was already so huge. And I was like, I could wait an hour and a half.
No.
And I was like, nah.
Now we can talk about the movie we really want to talk about.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. So the other screening, the one that I ran from the Hammerstein to get to, was Kaze-san and Morning Glories, which is a film adaptation of the manga, the more or less the same name. It's got this frustrating thing where every volume, it's Kaze-san and then what the and changes in every volume. So it's like the title of the series is Kaze-san and.
Like Yotsuba?
Yeah, more or less. And so it's like a love story about two girls in high school. One's like this kind of, she's this weird mix of, like, she's supposed to be kind of like meek, but she's also really like bubbly at the same time. Girl named Yamada, who's like the gardening committee girl at the school, so she's obsessed with gardening. She spends all her free time gardening. Who's in a relationship with another girl named Kase, who is the star of the track team. She's, you know, tall, statuesque beauty that, like, everyone likes. She's very much the stereotype, like, oh, it's the girl that all the other girls are in love with type character. And the movie is more or less just about their relationship in high school.
I really liked that it was about them being in it. Like, it wasn't about
them getting together.
That was sort of, like, briefly gone through, like, very quickly at the beginning of the movie. But I liked that it was about being in a relationship.
Yeah. So, a year or so ago, they did it's more or less a music video, like a short film. It's 7 minutes long, and that covers the first volume of the manga, which is them getting together. There's no dialogue, it's just music, and it's just them getting, it's building to the point of them getting together, and they made the conscious decision with the movie of, the movie is about them in the relationship. It's a 5-volume series, 1 volume is them getting together, the other 4 are about them in the relationship. Yeah, and that's a really nice thing about it, and that's something the director even talked about after the screening, was we made the decision that we wanted to tell a story about their being in a relationship, being in love with each other, and kind of what that's like, that experience, rather than what happened, how do they get together, which, like, so much of romantic stories, comics, manga, movies, that's what's, like, so much of it is, it stops at them getting together rather than the story of the relationship. Just like, this, you know, this is not the kind of thing you'd normally hear me talking about, but I super love this series, and I loved the movie version of it, because, one, it's really gorgeous, really lovingly animated, it's got a really great, like, color palette, it's got a lot of really soft color to it, which I thought was really, really nice looking.
It's soft, but at the same time, it's very saturated. Like, yeah. I feel like they've chosen a lot of, like, pastel, but yeah. It's a very saturated pastel palette. Also, like, the, just want to mention at the screening that, like, the small screen was, like, much more saturated than the big screen at the front, like the projected screen. The color was completely different between those two things. So I was like, I don't, not even 100% sure, like, which of these is correct. I didn't think the setup was great for the screenings. Yeah. So that was just a random aside. But, yeah, the movie was, it was like, I liked the director said it was sort of like a celebration of these two characters being in love. Like, there's some, like, you know, like little difficulties within, so it's not just like a saccharine fest or something. But it's more about like the joy that they're experiencing being with each other than like a lot of hardship. Which I guess is slightly different than the, I haven't read the manga, but that there's more conflict in the manga, I guess.
So there, like, because so, I asked him about that, like, at the Q&A afterwards, because there's a character that's completely excised from the movie version, which is Kaze's, like, senpai from her, from the track and field club, who, like, and there's, like, it's a very internalized conflict for, like, Yamada's character in that she is under the suspicion that this senpai is her ex-girlfriend, is Kaze's ex-girlfriend, and has made that assumption because through talking to her friends and things of that nature, she's kind of been under the impression that Kaze has been in relationships before, though Kaze herself has never said that. She has kind of this, like, internalized conflict of, is this other girl gonna come back and steal her from me, and, like, so it's much more about her confidence in her relationship kind of thing. And the director more or less said, we wanted to, like, we didn't want to have as major a conflict in the movie to kind of celebrate the relationship aspects of it, the fluffier aspects of it, without getting too overwhelming in the melodrama of it, which I appreciate a lot. And I think, like, I talked to you about this when I first started telling you about this series, because I think it was when I found out that it was going to be at New York, at this con, because it's something I've been a fan of for a long time. One of the things that makes it so special is that it's kind of, in a lot of ways, like a flip of the coin for so many, like, LGBT types, especially romance stories, in that a lot of them are very, very focused on that drama, in, like, the struggle of being in a you know, queer relationship or something of that nature. Whereas this is, the drama of this comes from just the natural drama of being in a relationship.
Any relationship.
In any relationship. That's what I mean, yeah. Just being in a relationship with another person and, you know, the anxieties about, like, are they happy with me? Are we, do I really deserve to be with them?
I think there's a lot of, all right, I've done it. I'm in a relationship. Oh, what does that actually mean? Like, what do we actually, like, yeah. I, like, dreamed of this, but now that I'm here, what do I do?
Yeah, like,
how do I make that person happy? How does this all work?
Like, the early part of the movie is all, like, Yamada's trying to get closer to her, but is struggling because Kaze gets pulled in all sorts of different directions. And she's like the whole conflict at the beginning of the movie is, I'm trying to make you lunch so we can eat together, but I'm never given the opportunity to say to you, hey, I made you lunch, let's eat together, until, like, you know, days have passed and she's super depressed over it at this point. And that's also the point where it's like, for, like, Kase's character, she recognizes that she's not playing her part in the relationship either. Like, she's, like, she's taking it for granted as well. And they have to, like, it, like, addresses that in the way they act with each other. It, yeah, the conflict, like, the drama of it is just relationship drama. And it's, in a lot of ways, a lot of it is very kind of lower, like, less...
Low stakes.
Low stakes, that's the word I'm looking for. The thing I really loved in the movie, and he talked about it a little bit at the panel, was the way it used water as, like, symbolically to, like, represent, like, Yamada's anxiety, especially in the latter half of the movie. Like, because the way the latter half of the movie is structured, it's, like, they're entering their third year, and Kase is getting, like, a recommendation to go to a school in Tokyo, and they live, like, in the middle of nowhere kind of place. And she's getting a recommendation to go to a big sports school in Tokyo, and Yamada's like, Well, my plan has always been to just go to, like, the local women's college and kind of just go from there to where my mom went, blah, 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 kind of thing. And it's her dealing with the anxiety of, like, I don't want to be separated from this person. This is the person I'm in love with. The thought of being alone or not being with them, like, is terrifying to me. But at that point in her life, she's never had to make that kind of decision before. It's like, she has to make, like, this big decision for her life. Am I going to, like, just roll with this and let this be what happens? Or am I going to fight for it and try and hold on to this relationship? Am I going to chase after her? That kind of thing. And there's an actual, like, scene where it's her. She more or less has a nightmare where she is literally drowning in, I mean, more or less in her own anxiety and depression and fear of losing this person. And it is a really cool scene in this movie. And a really interesting way to, like, express that visually, like, that stress and anxiety.
And I know that appears a lot in March Comes Like a Lion, because that character, Ray, is, like, had super problems with depression, and he's often pictured with water and drowning. I mean, yeah. The whole thing is they're in a river town, so that comes up a lot as well as a motif.
But I didn't pick up on it, but an audience member asked a question about the water. But what I thought was most interesting about his question, and then the way he's talked about it in the movie, is that it's not just visual. So it's a sound.
Audio,
so sounds of water are in the movie a lot, I guess, which I didn't even notice.
In a lot of the scenes where, like, you see Yamada getting, like, anxious or stressed about, like, what's going on, you start hearing water around her.
So it's not just a visual cue, and it's not always a visual cue. Sometimes there was a sound cue, which I thought, I was like, totally didn't notice that, and also, great job.
The other part is the director mentioned he was also the sound director,
the sound designer
for the movie. So, like, that was a very conscious thing that he did for this movie. But it was, like, a real labor of love project thing that they did. It was really cool that they had it here. It was screened at AX, too. And, yeah, Pony Canyon had it here and had a bunch of merch and stuff like that, too. Obviously, I'm a big fan of the thing, but, yeah.
And the manga's coming out from Seven Seas, so
the fifth volume is about to come out. It comes out, like, within the next couple weeks. If it didn't already come out, and I just didn't realize it.
Yeah, so I'm interested in picking that up. I'm going to see if they have it at the library. Yeah. I haven't read a lot of Girls Love, so, like, this seems like a really good one to start with. Or if you are, if you're like me and you've never really watched or seen a lot of this genre, I think this movie is also, like, a really good and seemingly good introduction. Seemed like got me very interested. So,
The short film that I mentioned earlier, the 7-minute, like, music video thing, is on YouTube, like, their official YouTube for Kasei-san. I think it might actually just be the Pony Canyon YouTube channel. I can't remember. But that's on there for free. There's no dialogue in it, so you can just watch it. And then that'll just make you really want to watch the movie. Which, like, the Japanese Blu-ray of comes out this week and has subtitles on it. So go buy it for $80 on Japanese Amazon. Or wait for Pony Canyon to put it out here for $80 on American Amazon.
All right, so final feelings about Anime NYC. I think we were trying to decide this, like, individually, like, or in, like, individual conversations, but better than the first year? And I think, you know, is it, like, must go to convention at this point, even after just this shorter period of time?
I feel like it still feels like a manageable expo, which I like, mostly because I still feel we have Anime Next and Otakon, which are definitely, like, the fan-friendly cons. So having, like, a more corporate con, I think, kind of gives a different flavor to the East Coast, and it gives us a chance to maybe draw in some of the guests and experiences that we get less here on the East Coast, which I am very appreciative of. So we don't just have the West Coast people just being na 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 na. So for that reason alone, I will continue to go and support it. But, I mean, it's a good con otherwise. But also, Spike. And if there's one thing...
Well, that's a Mendez trait.
Mm-hmm. So my answer is a little different, but very similar, I think, overall. I think it's almost a an absolute. But I think as of right now, it's directly tied to, like, the guest list. Because it's so industry-focused, and, like, the industry being there, blah, 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 I don't really give a shit, to be honest, but, like, if, you know, they bring over an interesting, like, mangaka, like, we brush over, like, you know, Range and Asada being there, like, you know, Japanese artists being there and doing drawing panels. We talked about that. You know, Toru Furia being there, all the musical guests being there, the director of Kase-san being there, the voice of Mob was there.
I mean, yeah, there was a ridiculous guest list.
And that's on top of that, all the American guests that, if you care about them, that were also there. So it's like, I feel like because it's so much more industry focused, the guest list becomes much more important to determining how interested I am in the con. That said, I think I still would have had a great time if almost any of that stuff went away. I think if you took the concert away, I kind of meh. But like, it was still fun to hang out with people at a convention, wandering around that exhibit hall and things of that nature, but that's just like, you know, I like hanging out with friends and talking about cartoons. I can do that outside of a convention if I need to. So it's pretty close to there. If there was more non-industry focused programming, that's like, to me, the thing that takes it from really good to like a must go is if it had like more fan programming. I don't think that's gonna happen, but that would be like the breaking point to me, because it's managed more or less as well or better than Otakon, frankly, in, like, you know, same size, more or less. Might be bigger. It was 36,000 this year. I don't remember what Otakon was this year.
That's bigger. So. But I also don't remember if they, like, count them different. Like, there's, like, weird... Yeah. I don't know. Like, the way people it's count... It's
turnstile or membership.
I don't know if they do them differently or not. Anyway, I think it is. I think, or it's comparable to the size.
Yeah, they're around the same size.
So, I agree with like both of you guys. Like, and I think you both have good points. I think because I live in New York City, it's not a big deal for me to like go to this con.
Yeah. Like so at this point, like so as you, like I just moved up here. Like as a local con,
it's great.
Like, if it was a con I had to travel to, it would be much, like, it's much more tied to all those things I'd mentioned. It's like, it needs to have those hooks.
And I was going to say, and they haven't put in all the hotels around there yet. Like, they're eventually planning to
put... Oh, yeah. But, like, also, I would never pay for a hotel in New York City. Or, like, in Manhattan, next to a giant convention center. But that is true. Where it's like, it's a pain in the ass to, you know, find a place to stay that's close by. And it's not like an Otakon where the convention and the hotel are connected to each other.
And it's just, like, harder to get around. But anyway, like, but I do feel that what you're saying about guests, I think still applies. Because I don't think I would, if there was no guests that I was interested in, I don't think I would go all 3 days. Like,
yeah.
I wouldn't take off, like, Friday
from work. I'd go Friday evening or something.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't take the day off, necessarily.
Yeah, I wouldn't, because if I'm not seeing a guest, really, like, my main priority is Artist Alley, and yes, it does take me, like, a good 3-4 trips through to really see everything, but that's still, I can do that in like 2 days, so it's not like it wouldn't be necessary for me if the guests like didn't add up 1 year. So I do see kind of your point about that being so much more central to like enjoying the con, because it's a bigger component than it would be maybe. It like guests are a big part of Otakon, but the Artist Alley there is like massive. The fan paneling is massive. So there's like lots of other things to do. Whereas at this con, like if I didn't get into a panel at this con that I was trying to get into, it was sort of like, oh, well,
what am I gonna do
for this hour or whatever?
Because there's so little programming every hour.
Right. So yeah, I do kind of see that. I think it was, for me, it was better than the first year, because the first year, I don't feel like I was, like, there was no Toriferia, essentially, the first year, so, like, but it was still, like, but I got to see a concert the first year, so, like, and that concert was baller. I mean, it was, like, amazing.
I mean, like,
so,
as much as I talk about, like, you know, how amazing Jam Project was, or how amazing Kageyama was, or all that blah, 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 nothing touches the Gundam Thunderbolt concert, because that shit was, like, a different kind of special.
Yeah, it was just totally unbelievable. Like, it was just, like, a, such a great experience. But, so yeah, I am not sure which year was better yet, but I do feel like if you are in the area, absolutely you should be checking out Anime NYC. Since I'm lucky enough to live here and not have to get a hotel, I have no idea what that situation is like. I do not even know, like, what the prices are. So, like, I feel like I'm not in a position to say, hey, you should travel. Like, you should go out of your way, travel here, like, make it happen. Whereas that's exactly what I would say about Otakon. It's like, no, it's worth the travel and it's worth the all the whatever. I don't know, like, but I think Anime NYC is, like, absolutely putting their best foot forward to make it that kind of a con, to make it the Anime Expo of the East Coast. Like, I think that's very clear. And considering their growth over just 2 years, it's, like, well on its way to doing that, I think.
And spite.
And I'm sure they're doing it out of spite, so.
I mean, so the guy running it was the guy that ran New York Anime Fest for Reed Pop before they merged it into New York Comic Con.
And killed it.
And killed it. And
stabbed it a lot.
And he works for the company Left Field, is another company that does, like, for-profit cons. They do Awesome Con out of D.C., which is a big Comic Con in D.C., so, like, it's not like they're a small outfit or anything like that. They know damn well what they're doing. And, like, for years, it was like, oh, yeah, Otakon's the big East Coast con. I think there is kind of a reality that's settling in that because Otakon, this comes all the way back to what we talked about at the very beginning of this thing, because Otakon is such a fan-focused con. It is a fan-run con. It is a fan-focused con. That is the experience of Otakon. That makes
sense. And that's what I love.
That's why Otakon's the best anime con, like, right?
Yeah, it's,
like, don't get me wrong. It's just, but that does have limits on the kind of growth you can have and the kind of, like, support you get out of the industry and that kind of stuff. Whereas, like, this con, it grows real quick. One, it's in New York City, and it's at a time of year where there's not a lot of other cons. But it's also, like, making a very conscious effort to be very similar to Anime Expo, where it's much more of a for-profit, like, industry-focused convention.
Now that you brought it up, though, I think the only danger for this con is that it's in November in New York City, and, like, the weather, like, I just feel like it's not necessarily, like, a popular time for people to travel. And if you don't like cold weather, I think that deters you a lot more than if you're, like, going somewhere that's, like, relatively warm in November, or, like, if you're from out of town. Like, obviously, if you're used to it, it's,
I mean,
not,
there were multiple, you know, guests that, like, had to, like, cancel panels and things like that because of the freak snowstorm that made everyone delayed. I know multiple people that were just coming to the convention who got to the convention super late because of it. So,
I know, yeah. I've been only showed up on Sunday.
Yeah.
Because his plane got, like, delayed in the
new. He was there Saturday, but, like, late.
Yeah.
Because his plane got canceled and then canceled and then delayed and then canceled and blah, blah, blah.
And so I do think that, you know, that's also...
There are risks.
There's risks, and I kind of wonder if... Well, I think it'll be, you know, they've already announced next year, but I'm just interested to see that if it continues to grow, if they actually change when it is. Because many people might not remember, but New York Comic Con actually occurred in February for a year, maybe only 1 year. But they then, like, skipped a year in order to move it to the fall. And I think that was, like, the best call for them, because February in New York City is the coldest motherfucking month. And we have blizzards fairly frequently in February. So So I do think that, I mean, we don't get a lot of blizzards. We did have the freak snowstorm. We've already talked about it. But, like, we don't get tons of snow in November, but it's still very cold. Or it can be very cold. So I'm just interested to see how that will play out over the next few years of their growth. And if they feel like it ever ends up hindering the growth of the con. But I think we're all in for next year, yeah?
Yeah.
Third year? All right.
At this point, I don't see any reason not to.
So once again, thank you to Pats from The Cockpit for joining us on this episode where we talked about Anime NYC, and we'll see you in December. That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.